In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. For today's podcast, we've got an interview with the historian and broadcaster Tessa Dunlop. Tessa is the author of a recent book about top-secret intelligence work of women at Bletchley Park during the Second World War. She was speaking down the line to Charlotte Hodgman, the editor of our sister magazine, BBC History Revealed.
Perhaps start by telling me, you know, what prompted you to want to write this book and what did you want to sort of get from it? What were you thinking when you first sort of had that idea?
Well, funnily enough, I'm going to be ruthlessly honest, because honesty is the best policy, I always think. I was, in fact, approached to write this book, and I was surprised because I couldn't even really do a Rubik's Cube. I was a 1980s school child, and, you know, I'm not a code breaker or a mathematician, and I was quite intimidated by the idea of diving into the world of Bletchley Park, where many had gone before me. And I was decided to accept the challenge because the publisher wanted the voices from only women, so it was exclusively to be about women. And secondly, all those women in my book were to still be alive. And that was particularly appealing because I think one of the problems for historians of Bletchley Park, and for anybody who's sort of a truth hunter, is that it's become, for many fairly obvious reasons, a big part of our sort of national mythologizing, you know, the way every country likes to tub thump about the positive bits of its past. And there's lots of bits about Bletchley Park that tie into a kind of that has acquired a myth-like status. And of course, it's the perfect sort of location for for historical fiction and for film and for literature. And what happens is you get a sort of tissue of storytelling and it becomes increasingly hard to discern fact from fiction. And therefore, it was very helpful to talk to the women themselves because they were able to establish what had really happened. Although I've got to caveat that with the dangers then of oral history, because remember that the way in which we remember our own personal life story is through this giant editing process. I mean, you or I, Charlotte, can't possibly remember everything from our childhood. No. We cherry pick the bits we want to. And likewise, the women who worked at the park. And what's really interesting about those women who worked at the park is that, of course, most of them had really no idea of the big picture, i.e. the organization that they were part of and its relevance or significance at the time. But lest we forget, there was this huge hoo-ha in the 70s, or rather a sort of drip feed that gradually built momentum into the juggernaut that's now become Bletchley Park. And they too dived in and started reading about it like the rest of us. So sometimes they would sit there telling me things that had happened, and I would say to them, but you couldn't possibly have known that at the time. And sure enough, they had retrospectively learnt about what they'd been doing. Do you see what I mean? So the whole thing was fraught with a series of sort of complications that I hadn't anticipated. I ought to just say very quickly, in terms of why Bletchley has become this, you know, area of national myth-making almost, I think I always liken it to a bit like a sort of the setting for an Agatha Christie book. You know, you need one location, one focus, a set number of characters, you know, and Bletchley Park in Buckinghamshire, closed off, secret. Mm. It has all the kind of key credentials for a really great narrative.
Yeah,
and I think that's what's keyed into our national psyche, and of course being attached this hugely historical significance, where it was so vital and fed into our victory, our Allied victory during World War II.
Mm. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, you talk about in the feature you've written about how the huge number of women who worked at Bletchley, which I'm sure most listeners wouldn't be aware of. I mean, in your book, you say that by 1944. Women outnumbered men at Bletchley 3-1. So why don't you think we've heard more of their stories before?
Because there's lots of reasons. I obviously, you know, we like a flamboyant character, an exceptional person, and the majority of those exceptional people at Bletchley Park were men. Mm. You know, the leading cryptanalysts, the Gordon Welchmans and the Alan Turings and the Tommy Flowers, who wasn't a cryptanalyst, he built the Colossus. These were male. Now, that's not to do down feminine intellect or our ability in computing and mathematics. It was simply that men were educated more and more thoroughly, and their education was prioritized than the education of their contemporary females. It's very interesting to me when I spoke to a lot of these women, their brothers would go off to university. Money had been reserved for their brothers' boarding school and university. And for them, it was, you know, the local school or some fairly second-rate governess, and then off to, you know, I don't know, secretarial college or something. More changed that narrative for some of them. But the bottom line is, still early on in the 20th century, education for women was not a priority. I mean, let's keep this real. I was born in 1974. I vividly recall my grandmother, who was of these Bletchley girls era, saying to me, education isn't as important for women. You know, so she was still carrying that. And we laugh, but arguably we still don't have the economic muscle power of men. Do you know what I mean? So it's not such a radical thing to say, hey, guess what? Girls weren't as educated as well as men, because they simply weren't. And Bletchley Park relied on, at the very top level, extraordinary minds. You know, an extraordinary machine or concept like the Enigma encryption, the level the Enigma was doing, needed something equally extraordinary at the other end to unravel it. And therefore, you have got to have been well educated. It can't just be, you know, a fluke genius who can do a crossword. That's, again, the kind of Bletchley myth machine. And so there were, I think, four women who were cryptanalysts in the entire park. It's funny because we all, I think, we're quite territorial about our family's heritage and our, you know, the way in which we tell our family stories. And one Bletchley girl who is no longer with us, actually, I wrote this book 3 years ago. She died a couple of years ago, but her daughter was absolutely adamant that her mother was a code breaker. And I'm like, well, I suppose, you know, when we do Sudoku or a crossword, we're code breakers. Mm. And so lots of the women who worked at the park, even though they weren't cryptanalysts, they weren't working at a very top level, you know, they were code breaking. You know, Roseanne, who's darling, you know, the most angelic woman, she spoke a bit of Italian because her father had worked in the diplomatic service over in Rome when she was a child. In fact, she saw Mussolini and she met Hitler, just to prove how living history these women were. She was a sort of code breaker in that she would get the code books from failed, downed Italian aircraft and have to work out, you know, kind of basic, she was given a basic code sheet, have to work out what these codes were saying. Now, that didn't mean that she was a genius mathematician, but she was sitting there doing her eight-hour shift and code breaking. And actually, at one point in the middle of the night, did break a very significant series of codes, which led to the Allies being able to down a series of Italian aircraft coming back across the Mediterranean. One of the downsides of Bletchley is that it has been, a lot of what's been said has become sort of difficult to discern from the fiction that's been wrapped around the narrative.
Mm. So, I mean, where did these women come from? How were they recruited to be working at Bletchley?
Oh, see, then we're going to tap into another little myth, which is that all the women at the park were posh. A lot of the women, in fact, the three featured predominantly in that article, are still very much alive and fully compos mentis.
Yeah.
And are quite sensitive, one or two of them, about this kind of reference to them being simply posh. However, at the beginning of the war, there were a disproportionate number of smart, the grand, in other words, girls who were recruited to Bletchley Park. And there were a couple of reasons for that. There was no idea of how big Bletchley Park would become. I mean, I liken it to a sort of code-breaking factory by the end of the war, you know, where thousands of people were working on a sort of conveyor belt of code-breaking and all the different compartmentalized areas. But at the beginning, it was a sort of much smaller, personal, but still intensely secret affair. By definition, of course, if the enemy knows that you're breaking its codes, that renders breaking them useless. So it had to be very, very secret from the outset. Now, it was also the brainchild of several top-end men in the Foreign Office, in the Cypher School, and also in I think it was particularly in the Naval Service, actually. Now, all men at that time, very high up in establishment roles, from the ruling classes, were pretty grand. And they had to recruit people to come and assist in an administrative capacity, predominantly these so-called boffins who were sort of landing in an unlikely park in Buckinghamshire to help. Now, if it's got to be very secret, who are you going to recruit? You're going to recruit the people you know. Mm. And therefore, you got goddaughters and daughters and wives initially pulled into the Bletchley Park project. It wasn't that, I mean, some, and in fact, one Lady Jean repeated something I often hear, which is, oh, well, it was believed that posh girls were more trustworthy. And I actually would challenge that. Nowhere did I see that written down or understand that to be the case. It was simply that these powerful men needed to recruit people they trust. And I think you trust people you know. Mm. So you recruit from your inner circles. And that's why these girls ended up at Bletchley Park. It ought to be said that a lot of them at the beginning were civilian. Now, the Foreign Office, which was the parent body of the Code and Cypher School, was had often employed women, especially in administrative and a supportive role. So it wasn't unusual, therefore, that they would have employed women anyway. And in the war, of course, tradition became a necessity because so many men were going off to the front line. Now, the reason why these posh girls, civilian girls, and the idea of them being somewhat grand is a distortion is because what happened in 1939-1940, of course, changed radically towards the end of the war, even in the middle of the war, when this project was sort of scaled up. You know, there was the letter sent to Churchill, you know, that much more money and resources were needed, and the level at which we were code breaking was absolutely gargantuan. So you get industrial sized machines being invented, and you also need industrial numbers of workers. And that meant that, you know, tapping up your goddaughter was no longer sufficient. It wasn't ever entirely delegated, but a huge heft of the recruitment pressure was handed over to the three military forces. And now by late 1941, for the first time in British history, anywhere you get conscription for women. And suddenly now the Wrens, the ATS and the WAFs are asked to recruit for Bletchley Park, particularly there was an emphasis on Wrens being recruited, it ought to be said, to Bletchley. So there was a disproportionate number of girls who thought they were going to go and work by the sea with a handsome sailor and actually ended up inside a sort of slightly monotonous park on the flatlands of Buckinghamshire. But there we go. So, yeah, so that was the narrative. But in the end, if you look at the numbers who went through Bletchley Park, numbers of female workers, the majority weren't from posh families, and they were also predominantly in uniform, although not all of them were in uniform. So there was always a mix of those in uniform and those in civvies. But again, you see at the beginning, those sort of flamboyant stories that include likes of Jean Trumpington, etc. Well, she was obviously a blue blood. She was probably, I don't know her story off by heart, but I know women who worked there with her. She will have been tapped up by somebody in the know. My Lady Jean, the aristocrat, the blue blood in the book I wrote about, you know, her father was told by Lord Mountbatten there was a job for a girl like her, you know, and those sort of stories are very memorable. And I think it's why they've led the female narrative regarding Bletchley and therefore that debutante story.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
She's convinced that when she was at Abbotscliff in Kent, that she saw Churchill and his Homburg hat and Monty's berry coming over the cliff. And I said, what? And she said, yeah, I gave them a great big grin like, and a wave. I couldn't think what to do. I wasn't in uniform that morning, she said. And she said, they walked on past. They gave me a wave back. She said, I think it was all part of the ruse to make the Germans think we were going to land in Pas-de-Calais.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
So what would it have been like actually working at Bletchley? We kind of, you know, you say in the feature as well that you get this idea of it being sort of full of intellectuals, you know, very sort of studious atmosphere. Was it actually like that? Is that what you kind of got from the women you spoke to?
Do you know, I feel I'm being a nightmare interview for you, Charlotte, because there's never, and this is what I found, I had 15 women. I spent about a year with 15 women, all of whom had worked in different aspects of the sort of Bletchley or code-breaking project. Now, some of those women didn't even work in Bletchley Park because they were the Y stations, you know, at the intersection coalface, if you like, getting these messages, these Enigma encrypted messages. And then the X station X was Bletchley Park, where they were received and processed and decoded. Now, it very much depends in life, whether you enjoy something or it's fun or work is interesting, depends on what you're doing and what you have to compare it to. So I was fascinated by just how different all the women's perception of what they did and how much they enjoyed it differed. Mm. And it's therefore quite hard to generalize. Lady Jean said, well, I would have had a much more interesting job had I been able to speak German. The girls who spoke a language had more interesting jobs. And she, it must be said that she had an incredibly dull job where she was, the most exciting thing was that she'd worked in the same hut as Turing. Yes, he had a sweet little face. And his so-called fiancée, Joan Clarke, oh, she wasn't nearly as pretty as Keira Knightley, that ridiculous film. But her job actually was sort of cross-checking the ticks on a piece of paper. She was, if you like, a sort of drum on a bomb machine for a bomb machine that had not yet been made. Do you see what I mean? So Sometimes these girls were literally a sort of bit part in a machine. Their jobs were so dull. It was marginally more interesting if you could speak, I suppose, a bit of basic level German. Then Pamela, who was doing the so-called indexing, you know, was said, oh, well, I suppose what I did was I sort of translated the equivalent of today's text message in basic schoolgirl German. And she wasn't terribly excited by what she did because she had really wanted to be an actress on the West End stage and had been forced by a godmother, you know, to do her bit and go to Bletchley Park. And she was also a little bit older. So I think when you've lived a bit and then coming to a park is a bit like ennui and dull. Whereas a lot of the later girls in particular who were recruited by the military services had come straight from school. You know, they'd just left their school uniform behind. So actually going to work in a park in Bletchley was quite exciting no matter what job they were given, you know, being part of this war effort that they'd heard and read so much about. So in that respect, some of the younger ones were riveted by it. A couple of girls were lucky enough to find husbands there. It was pretty difficult because the men who were left behind working were intensely academic and all pretty old in comparison with a sort of 16-year-old schoolgirl. But a couple found their husbands, which of course makes it more memorable, doesn't it? It's a bit of kiss and tell behind a shed. it absolutely depended on the individual. What I would say, the one hallmark that all of them shared the one overriding memory was this emphasis on secrecy. Mm. So even if some had quite interesting jobs, like Roseanne, of course, with her Italian, schoolgirl Italian, being able to break those codes that led to the downing of several Italian aircraft. That was, you know, a big moment for her. Mm. And also she met Pamela, the actress. And so she met this really cool girl in the park. You know what it's like when you're 18? Yeah. You meet a couple of people who you feel are out with your standard social circle and your mind's blown. You know, you get your schoolgirl pash and, you know, and you do a bit of extracurricular drama and maybe drink your first ever gin and French. And you think, you know, you're the bee's knees. So irrespective of whether the shift is slightly dull and the rations are limited. So it depended. But just to go back, that emphasis on secrecy, because I said, oh, well, none of the women really understood they were part of this bigger code breaking organization. But Pamela, who ended up being married, I think, to the head of her hut, Jim Rose, of course, said she did know exactly what the park was doing and that it was code breaking. And so, again, you can't generalize, but most girls had no clue really of the bigger picture. And that meant that had the enemy got hold of them and pulled them by the scruff of the neck and, you know, squeezed them till the pips squeaked, they wouldn't have really been able to have said anything anyway.
No.
Because the ultimate ignorance, you know, the ultimate disempowerment is ignorance. Mm.
Did they get to, so they didn't, so they were very much sort of working in their own huts. They didn't get to see other huts or see what else was going on elsewhere in the park.
It was totally compartmentalized. You know, there's one little job to do and they were doing it. And if you think so, so Pat's down in Abbot's Cliff. Where's that? Down in Kent. Mm. And she's, you know, listening to Alpha, Beta, Mata, whatever the German alphabet is, you know, frantically taking down this Enigma code and not knowing it's Enigma encoded, incidentally, not having a clue what Enigma is and sending it off on a teleporter machine to Station X, not knowing where Station X is, not really knowing what she's doing. Then somebody's Charlotte, who's another woman, is, you know, receiving all this data and sort of filing it. Because what do you do with, by this stage, you know, mid-war, thousands and thousands of communications are coming in, they need filed. Well, Charlotte doesn't really know what she's filing, she's just doing what she's told. And I think it's really easy to forget the deferential era that we then lived in. You know, Joanne, one of the women who worked with the Colossus, she was a Wren, said, oh, nowadays girls would blab. And again, I'm like, I don't know if that's the case. If there was a war on, would we blab? If it was a life and death matter, it's just that's not, thank the Lord, been required of our generation, and therefore it's very hard to counter charges that we are sort of, you know, more gossipy than the generation before. But we certainly are less deferential, that's for sure. It might be harder for us to train ourselves to be stumm, because those women from that generation were brought up knowing they could not talk, you know, and they couldn't talk back at authority. You know, they would, and they'd just come out of school. You know, you abided by your parents' rules, by your school rules, by the rules set by patriarchal society. And then there's a war on. So there's a whole nother layer of kind of, you know, making sure you shut up. And what's really interesting is actually in the 70s, when the story came out, because it became too hard to contain, and also because it was less sensitive by that stage. What's interesting, if you look back at the history, it was men determined to write up their own role for posterity, who were the ones that were desperate to blab, including Churchill. When he wrote up his histories, he had to be sat down. I think it was the name of the commission that had to have a quiet word with him. But he had to take out all the references to this golden, you know, golden goose. Well, what did he refer to it as? Come on, Charlotte, help me out.
The golden goose that never laid an egg.
The never cackled, that's it.
That's right, cackled, yeah.
So he was frightfully pleased, Churchill, in the wake of the war, the role of, you know, encryption and code breaking in Bletchley Park and his part in it as a supporter of it, and somebody had the vision to recognise that it was something worth backing from the outset. And yet he couldn't show off about it in his lifetime. That's gutting to a big male ego. And there were plenty of big male egos kicking around. In comparison, women were used to not being as educated, playing the handmaiden to men's success, not being asked about their role in the war, thank you very much. Nobody's very interested in what women do during the war. It's about men and lionizing men's success and men's heroics. So actually, not just during the war, but also after the war, arguably it was a great deal easier for women to not talk about what they'd done. On top of which, it was more men who had the bigger overall picture of what that code breaking meant to the war effort, men like Churchill, than, I say little in inverted commas, women just out of school working in a small dingy hut in Buckinghamshire, longing for their next end of break and wondering what their ration was going to throw up that evening.
How did these women feel then when they actually found out what they were, the big project that they were part of? Was it a shock?
For some of them, it was a delight. Others were shocked, partly because they'd, you know, were sworn to secrecy, the Official Secrets Act. That's what this one uniform experience, that them being committed to being secret. And therefore, to suddenly discover that that was sort of null and void in their late middle age was something of a revelation, yeah, and a shock. I think it was, for some, it's definitely latterly, now that there's been a light shone on women, the women's role, I think it's been a great joy. Ruth Bourne, one of the fantastic stalwarts of Bletchley and constantly campaigning and working and enlightening people as to what their work was there. She was a bomb operator, a Wren and a bomb operator. You know, she'll talk about the invisibility of old age, especially if you're a woman. You know, nobody's going to ask an old wrinkly, she'll say, what they've been up to. And suddenly, actually, to have their moment in the sun and their voices recognised and their role recognised has been hugely important.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking today, we're talking just a few days away from the big 75th anniversary of D-Day. And obviously Colossus had, played, quite a big role, in the run-up.
Massive,
to that.
Yes.
Were any of your women that you spoke to, were they involved with Colossus and the sort of the preparations for D-Day?
Pat Davis, who worked in Kent, she was Station Y feeding Station X, which was Bletchley Park, with the intercepted Enigma codes. And she writes, she's convinced that when she was at Abbotscliff in Kent, that she saw Churchill and his Homburg hat and Monty's berry coming over the cliff.
Wow.
And I said, what? And she said, yeah, I gave them a great big grin and a wave. I couldn't think what to do. I wasn't in uniform that morning, she said. And she said, they walked on past, they gave me a wave back. She said, I think it was all part of the ruse to make the Germans think we were going to land in Pas-de-Calais. You remember, so part of our tricking the Germans was to make them think that we weren't going to land where we landed, where D-Day actually originally set foot in France. It was further north. And so she has an absolute belief that this was a tactical visit was what she saw when she came out of her station finding tower in Kent that morning.
Wow.
And there she saw them. So that was quite exciting for her, really. Mm. And it was massive, the role of Bletchley Park, Operation Fortitude, you know, deliberately seeking to deceive the Germans into believing that we were going to land in Normandy and Calais. So there was that side of it. But there was also, you're right to mention Colossus. Colossus was interesting because I think always the bomb and Alan Turing have sort of stolen the headline of Bletchley Park, where actually the first computer was the Colossus because it was programmable, whereas the bomb was an electronic testing device. It didn't have that extra layer of sophistication. And the Colossus, which is sort of, I always think they're sort of like giant sci-fi eggs. And it was so really rudimentary, despite its sophistication, that it couldn't really be turned off. Once you switched it off, then gearing it back up again was seen as a nigh on an impossibility. So they were left running all the time. And anyway, code breaking was a 24/7 job. And the Lorenz was encrypting stuff, often from the German high command. I mean, things signed off by Adolf Hitler himself. Now, these machines, because they were left on night and day, had to sort of have their very own handmaidens, really, they're nurses. Mm. And these were, this job was delegated to Wrens, who were bussed in because there was no longer room to billet them in and around Bletchley Park. They were bussed in and they would arrive and look after this sort of wacky combination of science and magic, is how Joanne described it. Had a little eye she'd polish and, out would come the ticker tape and so on and so forth. She didn't really have a damn clue what she was up to, but did what she was told. And what's extraordinary is, of course, that the messages that were coming through were absolutely vital to not only telling us or giving us a sort of a glance at the card hand, if you like, of the Germans, but also giving us a sniff of how near victory we were by the end. Mm. Although, again, that was kept very muted. If Bletchley Park was ahead of the game and some people knew stuff before others, they weren't allowed to go around having premature celebrations, because that would be the cat out of the bag.
That was Tessa Dunlop. Her book, The Bletchley Girls, is available now, published by Hodder. You can read Tessa's feature on the women who worked at Bletchley in the July issue of BBC History Revealed, which is out now. Thanks for listening. Today's podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. We'll be back on Monday when I'll be speaking to Tim Bouverie about 1930s appeasement.